Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Living History. Thank you for the feedback you've given us, particularly about when we were coming live from the battlefields. Pete Smith and I were live in both Ypres and the Somme. It was a really good podcast to do, and thanks for all the feedback you've given us about that. If you haven't listened to it, go back and check it out, because it was good fun to be over there with Pete and actually walking the ground. Not doing the First World War this week, we're doing something a little bit different, a subject that's really close to my heart. And it's been 160 years since some key battles of the American Civil War. And it's a subject that, particularly in Australia, I think we don't spend enough time talking about, because this was a huge world event that had repercussions that echo, well, even today in modern-day America. So 160 years, it's a long time ago. But I wanted to have a chat about it, particularly about the Battle of Antietam, which took place in September 1862, one of the key battles of the Civil War. Joining me to talk all about it is Dale Blair. Dale, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Thanks for having me.
Mate, before we get stuck into the details about the Battle of Antietam and the Civil War, just tell us your story, because obviously you're an Aussie, you're not an American, yet you have this fascination for the American Civil War. Where does that come from?
Yeah, it comes from grade six, actually. I fell in love with a book called Heroes in Blue and Grey, which was a Walt Whitman series book, which was basically part of the centenary, was written as part of the centenary. And it was pretty much a boy's own book about the Civil War. You know, each chapter was about a specific battle and a particular general or character in that battle. And I guess, you know, I didn't have a lot of no academic ground in it at all, obviously, as a 10-year-old, and there wasn't a lot on the Civil War, just the odd encyclopedic reference and whatever you saw on Western movies in the that came out of America and some of the series that were on, and so I guess I sort of gravitated to having some empathy with the Southern sort of side of things, not from the political standpoint, but just from the fact that they were so outnumbered and they fought this, if you like, good fight for 4 years, whereas they probably shouldn't have got that far. And so that was just where I got started with the Civil War generally. And Antietam speaks to that on a number of levels, because it's the battle that the South should never have got out of. They really should have been crushed at Antietam. Lee's army should have been crushed there. And it was a huge lost opportunity for the North.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking more about that. We can't really talk about the Civil War without addressing, you know, the very positive movements that are going on at the moment, particularly in relation to a changing perspective on this idea of the lost cause. And the lost cause, for those who don't know, is the suggestion that the South were not fighting about slavery, that they were fighting just for states' rights, and they were fighting because the North was throwing their weight around, and that the South could have won and formed its own nation and gone on to do wonderful things, if not for the fact that the North just overwhelmed them with manpower and industry. we're redressing that lately. People are starting to say that is a myth that grew up after the Civil War because people didn't like the idea that they'd lost the war and they wanted some way of justifying what had gone on. The modern thinking is more along the lines of the South was fighting to retain slavery and that it was a rebellion against the country that they, you know, that soldiers had sworn to fight for. Where do you stand on that today? Without getting too political, where do you stand on that today?
Look, I think we're just in catch-up mode at the moment. And you, when you think about what has gone on in American history in, around race, it all goes back to the American Civil War and that sort of, and it was a catharsis that really should have addressed it more than it did, and unfortunately, the old Southern leadership, if you like, was pretty much reinstated after the war, and things were allowed to go the way they did with segregation and African Americans as second class citizens. And you really, with the statues in particular, if you think about the statues that are being pulled down, well, you know, this is community speaking now about the inappropriateness of those statues in their communities. And yes, there's a lot of these communities are predominantly black communities because they live in the South, and that's fair enough. That's the way it goes. But I think also there's a lot of people in the South too who are open to this idea that, you know, a great wrong was done and that history does actually be redressed, and if they're to move on with that. Obviously, you're going to have some unreconstructed Confederates that don't like what's happening, but ultimately I think, you know, that the former mayor of New Orleans, the speech he gave about the removal of the statues in New Orleans was fantastic. And if anybody wants to really doubt what it was about from the Confederate point of view back in the 1920s, et cetera, just read the speech that was given at Duke University when they put up the statue of the Confederate soldier at Duke. And it was really all about redressing white power in the southern states, you know. So, yeah, look, we're coming full circle, I think. I mean, there's a great, I think, deal of laxity on the part of the North, and I think weariness too after the war in actually prosecuting that new ideal, if you like, about equality. But they've sort of got there. Eventually.
Yeah, it's a long journey, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's been going on for 160 years, but I mean, even longer. There's a fantastic new book called Robert E. Lee and Me by Ty Seidel about, he's a retired West Point graduate, actually. So he's of cut of the cloth that that these men of the Civil War came from, and he is a proud Southerner. But it's just about him, again, redressing that myth of the lost cause, and that's a fantastic book for anyone who hasn't read it. Robert E. Lee and Me, go out and check it out. It's a really good book. Thanks for your comments on that, Dale. We should move forward to what I think we commemorate on this podcast is not the politics and not the ideologies, but it's the sacrifice of the men in the front line. And when it comes to battles of the Civil War, there was not a lot more sacrificing done than at Antietam 160 years ago. Before we get into the details of the battle, just give us a very quick background on what had happened in the Civil War up to this point and how the two sides were poised before the battle.
Well, one of the things to remember, Antietam actually is only 16 months into the war, so it actually happens quite early on. So there's been 16 months of fighting, and a lot has happened in that time. And Antietam is really only one of 10,000 military engagements that occurs during the Civil War. So as a Civil War, the American Civil War is really a bit off the charts in terms of the frenetic military activity that was going on.
I should just say there, when you say 10,000, you mean literally 10,000, don't you? That
literally
wasn't just a figure plucked out of thin air.
No. It's over 10,000 military engagements, so where people shooting in anger at one another. So, it's a significant a number of things, 76 pitched battles, of which Antietam is one. And, of course, Antietam is the bloodiest day of the Civil War, so it holds that grim kind of honour, if you like, or place in history. But from the outset of the war, from the time the first guns were fired, the South started losing territory. So it was on the back foot fighting a defensive war. By 1862, the blockade is pretty much in full full swing around the southern ports. Yes, blockade runners can go in and out, but that's increasingly becoming more difficult as more Union ships are brought into the blockade. So it's a very effective strategy, the Anaconda strategy that Winfield Scott had sort of advocated prior to the war or at the war's outset. By 1862, Nashville has fallen to the Union. Early 1862, Nashville has fallen to the Union. New Orleans has fallen to the Union. By mid-year, Memphis has fallen along the Mississippi there as well. And the Confederacy never holds those border states, so it's never in full control. So Tennessee and Virginia are really contested battlefield or battlegrounds. A third of the those 10,000 engagements that we talked about occur in those two states. And also from the Confederates' point of view, that's where most of the Confederate soldiers are drawn from, or the majority from those two states. And so by June of 1862, you have the Shenandoah Valley as being it's been occupied by the federal forces in the Eastern Theater. McClellan's army is on the doorstep of Richmond, threatening to take over the Confederate capital. And then all of a sudden, things change for the Confederacy in the Eastern Theater. Robert E. Lee becomes the commander after Joseph E. Johnson is wounded at the Battle of Seven Pines, and Lee immediately goes on to the offensive. He drives McClellan back during the 7 days battle. McClellan, really, it's just a lack of will on his part. The Union Army, had he have had the medal, could have stood and probably stopped Lee's advance at any number of those battles and held on. But they don't. McClellan retreats, gives up the advantage to Lee. Lee then swings onto the offensive, moves north. Stonewall Jackson, who had conducted a very impressive campaign in the valley prior to the 7 days battle, goes into northern Virginia. They concentrate against a reconstituted Union army, the Army of Virginia under John Pope. They defeat that army at the Second Battle of Manassas. And now all of a sudden, that army retreats back on Washington. McClellan's army is in transit back to Washington from the peninsula. And all of a sudden, there's no federal troops that can actually oppose the Confederates in northern Virginia. And Lee decides to go on the offensive and take his army into Maryland. So, and Lee's army at that stage is not fit for an extended campaign. It's fought the 7 days battle. That's Stonewall Jackson's command has fought the Valley campaign. On top of that, it's fought the Second Battle of Manassas and been hard marching all through all of those campaigns. So it's really in no condition for an extended campaign. But Lee believes that the risks outweigh, the risks are worth undertaking because the gain that he might extract from that is consummate to the risk. So that's where they're at. And some of the reasons for that is that, one, it gives a chance for the Confederate breadbasket, the Shenandoah Valley and other farms in Virginia, to get some relief from the war, to actually get their crops in free of Union interference, and then feed the Confederate Army, etc. The other ones are more political. So if the Confederates get into Maryland, there's a hope that they might galvanize the Marylanders in that state to come across and to the Confederate cause. There's also the political will of the North. There are midterm elections, obviously due in 1862. And if you can put pressure on the Union government or the federal government by inflicting defeats on their armies, then that may have there might be repercussions for the Union in those elections. And also it's sending a message overseas to France and Britain that the Confederacy is, in fact, a viable entity. And so these are some of the things that are weighing on President Davis's mind and also Robert E. Lee's mind when they go north. The Union Army, of course, is in a bit of a state of flux. As I said, the Army of Virginia has been defeated. McClellan's army is still in transit. And so Lee goes into Maryland, and he starts to cross between the 4th of September and the 7th of September. He sets up a supply base in Frederick in Maryland, and he wants to capture the Union garrison at Harper's Ferry, which is now cut off effectively by crossing the river, the Potomac River. And so he divides his army up to deal with the Union forces down at Harper's Ferry. And he divides his army into five segments, basically. So he's got a rear guard, he's got Longstreet's advance moving further north into Maryland, and he sent Stonewall Jackson back to Harper's Ferry, and he goes across the river there and surrounds Harper's Ferry. Now, fortuitously, and here this we've got to think about the minds of the generals, Lee has assessed that McClellan is risk-averse, that he cares a lot about his own reputation, and he won't risk battle, and he will be slow to move. This proved to be the case on the peninsula. It also, Lee is banking that it will be the case in Maryland. On the 13th of September, a couple of federal soldiers are having a rest on the side of the road, and they find a couple of cigars wrapped in a piece of paper. That piece of paper is Lee's special order number 191, which details his orders to the army and the positions of his army. This is, of course, taken to McClellan. McClellan, this is a bonanza for him. He gets his army on the move, and they move quickly toward the South Mountain, to the mountain passes where the Confederate rear guard is situated. I think it's McClaw's division. And they hold three gaps there. It's the Foxes, Crampton's Gap to the south, and then Fox and what's the other one? Forgotten what the other one's called. It doesn't matter. Anyway, those three mountain passes are being defended. So there's a battle ensues, and the Federals push the Confederates out of those mountain passes, or at least two of them, which makes the Crampton's Gap untenable. And the Confederates now start to withdraw back down into the plain toward Sharpsburg. We should mention that the battle is called Sharpsburg by the South more often after the town, and by the North call it Antietam after the creek which runs to the west of the town, east of the town, I should say.
I just wanted to jump in there and ask about that unbelievable luck that went towards the Union soldiers of finding that order wrapped in a couple of cigars. I mean, it seems like something that if you put that in a movie script, they would reject it as being too preposterous.
Yeah, too fanciful. Has
there ever been any explanation as to how that actually occurred?
Look, I think there has been. It was a courier who was one of the officers that was, but I forget exactly who it was. But but it was one of the officers obviously privy to that information who, I don't know, just dropped out of his saddlebag or his, I don't know how it got to the ground, but it was a huge piece of luck for the Union Army and McClellan. And he moves with alacrity. He actually moves very quickly to take up that advantage. Lee, of course,
it's the thing
now
about Lee's plans is that the thing that always strikes me about Lee's plans is this war should have been a guerrilla war. The South was never going to win a conventional war against the North, but they didn't have to win the war per se. They just had to get to a point where the North was sick of fighting. And we saw it in Vietnam. We've seen it in so many conflicts where the smaller enemy defeats the larger one by simply making them bleed more until the larger one loses their will to keep fighting. It's funny at this stage, though, that Lee seems to be quite determined to wage these much more conventional large battles. And I know in particular that the invasion of Maryland didn't sit well with his troops, many of whom in the South had signed up to defend the South. And now the idea of heading north becoming the invaders themselves was something that didn't sit well with a lot of his troops.
Yeah, that's true. And there's quite a bit of straggling and desertion on the part of the Confederates because they simply don't want to go into Maryland. And they're exhausted as well. This is the other thing, that those soldiers are pretty well exhausted. But back to your point about the guerrilla warfare, that to us from our 21st century and 20th century sensibilities seem like the obvious thing. And you look to the Boer War, for instance, in which the Boers fought a very effective war against the British with those unconventional tactics. But Lee wasn't trained that way, and nor were the Civil War generals. Lee, in fact, did not like the idea of guerrillas. He did not trust the guerrilla partisan rangers, etc., that were part of the Confederate military at that time in Virginia. So he believed in the ultimate battle, the canaille, that you could destroy the enemy army on the field. And, of course, the repercussions of that politically would be huge if you could manage to pull off a victory like that. But, no, it was to all intents and purposes, from Lee's point of view and probably most of the senior generals, both North and South, it was a conventional war. They did, of course, have to deal with guerrillas later in the war or from the start of the war throughout the war, actually. So, and, of course, many of the guerrillas didn't cover themselves in glory with some of the behaviour and the way they waged war, and that didn't sit well with a lot of generals as well, of course. But back to Antietam, Lee now has to concentrate his army, which he decides to do at Sharpsburg, and he takes up a position. Now, Sharpsburg's situated, it's about 17 miles from Harper's Ferry, and it's situated between the Potomac on the west side of the town and Antietam Creek on the east side of the town. So Lee sets his army up between those two rivers or between those two waterways, takes up a defensive position and basically awaits McClellan to come and attack him in that position. It's not a strong position defensively. The ground is fairly open, undulating. There's some woods on the left of the position. But basically the centre of the position and all the way in front of Sharpsburg, right across to just south of Sharpsburg and to the river just to the immediate east of Sharpsburg. That's pretty open ground, and it was a good position for artillery of both sides. It was, as I said, they had good fields of fire. And the battle actually became known as Artillery Hell because of the effectiveness of the artillery from both sides during the battle. And so the battle is going to take place. Lee just waits. McClellan turns up with six corps and gets ready to attack Lee on the 17th of September. And the battle opens up in the morning at 5:30 in the morning, and then it's going to rage across the Confederate front until it peters out in the afternoon with an attack across the Stone Bridge on the right side of the Confederate line.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Both sides in this battle actually don't put all of their troops into the battle at the start. Lee, in fact, is still waiting for troops to come up from the various points of the compass that he's brought them in. So he actually starts with only 26,000 men available in the line when those first federal attacks begin at 5:30 in the morning. And so then you have, it's the, I think, the first corps that opens the attack. It attacks through the cornfield and through the known as the West Woods and the East Woods. The Confederates are holding a position pretty much just south of the West Woods, and they come forward and they meet the federal line as it enters the cornfield and enters the East Woods. And this battle rages back and forth for 2 hours. It's just, you know, men getting shot down. The cornfield's about 6 foot high. You can only see the flags of the troops as they're moving through. By the time the battle's over, that cornfield's about an inch high and just full of dead from both sides. That portion of the battle comes to a close after Hood's under General Wofford, Hood's brigade of Hood's division, makes a counterattack and finally drives the Union forces back, and then they sit and wait for the next phase of the attack. Now, it's worth noting, Matt, is that the condition of both of these armies. 25% of the Union army are what we call green troops. They're nine-month men who had been rushed into the army because the Union had stopped recruiting during the Peninsula campaign, and they all of a sudden needed more men again. So 25% of these Union forces have never seen a major battle before, and this is a major hindrance to them marching to the battlefield and also in the way that they conduct themselves on the battlefield. So that's something to keep in mind. Lee, on the other hand, has got an army full of veterans. His army has fought in a number of battles now, and he's got very few green troops, in fact, probably none, in his... And it makes a huge difference on the battlefield, that troops that know what they're doing, that have been under fire before, that can actually handle the heat. And so that's one advantage that Lee has in this battle, which is probably not acknowledged enough, by a lot of scholars in terms of what McClellan was dealing with. That's not to excuse McClellan of a lot of mistakes that he does actually make. So then about 7:30, the 12th Corps now enters the fray. They repeat the same thing, come through the East Woods, through the cornfield. Stonewall Jackson's about three brigades are throwing in against them, and that fighting rages back and forwards once again. Now, interestingly, the one division of the 12th Corps that isn't green is General Greene's division, ironically, and they actually managed to hold a position just east of the West Woods near the Dunkard Church, and they're holding that position while the rest of the Union forces have kind of withdrawn or fallen back toward the northward from whence they had come. So now at about 9:30, General Sumner with his second corps is sent into the attack. He has three divisions, and the first of those is under John Sedgwick, and it is sent basically diagonally across the battlefield. It goes past Greene's division on the right, and then it goes past the right of Greene's division. And then its right wing actually passes in front of the federal forces that have actually fallen back. So it basically goes through this big gap in the federal line, and it hits the West Woods in three lines. And, of course, this is where the Confederates are holding their position. And Sedgwick's division comes across in three lines across the front of the Confederate defenders there. And, of course, they enfilade the division. It is cut to ribbons and effectively put out of the fight for the rest of the day. The other two divisions have actually been, there's sort of a low ridge of high ground that kind of sees the other two divisions sort of diverge off down toward the Sunken Road, which is being held by D.H. Hill's division. And so around about 10 o'clock, those two divisions start to attack, with French's division in the lead, Israel Richardson's division behind it, and they attack the Sunken Road where D.H. Hill has got three brigades sitting. This fighting rages back and forth. French's division are 9 of the 10 regiments are green regiments. So they're these 9-month men. They are cut to pieces, but also the casualties among D.H. Hill's men are heavy. R.H. Anderson's men are thrown into the division, is sent in support of D.H. Hill. Israel Richardson's division attacks. That includes Thomas Marr's Irish Brigade, which has got a lovely Australian connection to it. And eventually, by about 1 o'clock, the Confederate line collapses in the sunken road, and they fall back up the hill, up the ridge to where the Confederate guns are situated. And so now the fighting now moves away from that position to what we call the lower bridge, which becomes famously known as Burnside's Bridge. Now,
just before we get to that, Dale, I have to find out what was the Australian connection you briefly touched on.
Yeah. So Thomas Marr was a young Islander, and he was sent out to Australia to Van Diemen's Land, exiled to Van Diemen's Land, with a number of other young Islanders. I think there were 7 in all. And he, of course, he escapes from Van Diemen's Land eventually with the aid of one of the Catholic priests in one of the local towns here in Richmond, I think. And he makes his way to America. And there, of course, he goes to New York, gets involved there. And then when the Civil War breaks out and the Irish people in New York are enlisting, Marr ends up becoming the leader of the Irish Brigade, which had, you know, the famous 69th New York Zouaves, and that is part of their regiment. He was known as Marr as the Sword because of his eloquence as a speaker and writer. And so that was the little connection there. He goes on, I think he becomes governor of Michigan, I think, after the war, or Minnesota, one of the states in the north. That begins with them. But anyway.
A great story. I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah, so...
But I interrupted you. Back to the bridge.
So back to the bridge. So this is about 1 o'clock when the Confederate position has collapsed at the Sunken Road. Around just prior to that, Franklin's 6th Corps has crossed over Antietam Creek and is now on that side of the river behind all the Union forces, the 1st Corps, the 12th Corps that have all made their attacks already. And second corps, so it's sort of a reserve that hasn't been used, and it's now across the river. So it's threatening that it could actually do some damage to the Confederates on the left if the attack is renewed. Franklin, the commander, asks McClellan if he can actually attack. McClellan declines, doesn't allow him to. So the 6th Corps remains basically static. Then we move down the 5th Corps, which is holding the centre of the Union line, but on the other side of Antietam Creek, opposite Middle Bridge with Pleasanton's cavalry. That corps had been banged up pretty badly on the peninsula, very good troops, but now really exhausted and not in great fighting form. So they were being held more or less as a reserve. They were also short of a division, which had still not come up. Again, this new division gets up the next day, and it was entirely made up of 9-month men, so a completely green division. So it's static as well. The 5th Corps is static. And then we have Burnside with the 9th Corps. He's sitting opposite the lower bridge. Now, he had been ordered to be prepared to get ready for attack at 7 o'clock in the morning. And he did that. He was ready in position to attack. He doesn't get attack orders until about 10 o'clock in the morning. By this time, the fighting is, you know, is finished over on the far left of the Confederate line, still going over at the Sunken Road. And so he sends his troops forward. The Confederates have been taken from the right of their line to send to the left of their line. So they're actually really thin on this part of the battlefield. There's 450 Georgians under Robert Toombs defending the crossing, where the bridge comes across. It's quite steep ground there, lots of trees, stone walls, quite good area to defend. There's sharpshooters involved in that, and they hold the federal lines up significantly for a couple of hours. until they start to run out of ammunition. They've also got artillery support that's up on the hills that's firing down on the Union lines as well. So it's a sticky proposition. It's often said, and I think this is unfairly so, that Burnside could have waded across the bridge on either side, that, you know, and that may have been true, but they were getting shot up and stopped before they even got to the water. So whether it was fordable at waist level or what was a moot point, really, if you're not actually even getting to the water's edge. So, but finally, a brigade does form in columns, it gets artillery support, and it charges across the bridge. And so about 1 o'clock at the same time that the sunken road position has collapsed for the Confederates, so too do the Union forces get across the bridge at the lower bridge. It then takes them, again, it's there's still Confederate troops in there, there's Confederate artillery there, and now Lee is starting to try to filter more men back from the left, back to the right to try and hold that position. So the Confederate position is tenuous at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Their brigades are shattered in the Westwood. They've been driven out of the sunken lane, or the sunken road, bloody lane, and now the Union are across the creek on the right-hand side of the Confederate line. The Union have also sent a division down to a place called Snavely's Ford, which should have been reconnoitred much earlier, and because they had to find it and then get across it. Rodman's division, it gets across. It's a mix of seasoned troops and green troops. It gets across, and that's extending, stretching the far right of the Confederate line, so it's actually sort of getting up behind the right rear of the Confederate position. By 3 o'clock, Burnside has all his troops across the creek and is now preparing to push forward against the Confederate line in that position. Now, the Confederate line is stretched. It's Longstreet's command principally, but it's fairly good ground to defend here. It's quite steep overlooking the river, but there's lots of cornfields, there's lots of stone fields and little knolls, etc. And so whilst the Confederates are stretched and their numbers are thin, they are actually able to put up a fairly stiff resistance here. But the battle is, with Rodman's turning movement, is starting to look fairly grim again for the Confederates. And at this point, A.P. Hill's division, which is marching up from Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry had surrendered on the 15th. Most of the troops had been sent up to Lee on the 16th, but A.P. Hill had to stay back to obviously oversee the surrender of 14,000 Union troops. And he had put his troops on the road, and they were marching, and they arrive around about 3:30. They start to arrive just as Rodman's division is starting to threaten the Confederate right and rear. And they save the day, basically. They are able to drive back Rodman's division, and then the battle comes to a close after about 4:30 or 5 o'clock. At that point, the fighting ceases. As I said, all up in that day's fighting, over 23,000 casualties from both armies. So it's the bloodiest day of the war. In that sense, as a battle, it stands with Gettysburg and the Wilderness for the bloodiness of the battle. Lee actually holds position the next day. And think about this, that McClellan has the 6th Corps hasn't been used, the 5th Corps hasn't been used. He has used two-thirds of his army. So Lee has put all his men in, about 40,000. McClellan, in the end, has probably only used about 60,000 of his troops, of which about 20% of those that were in action were green troops, so which is a huge hindering factor. And it's interesting how they dealt with those green troops, and I only learned about this recently, but I mean, Civil War commanders, they weren't stupid. They worked out. So when you had green troops, what you did was that they would generally take up the center of your line in a brigade. So if a brigade had 5 regiments, you would actually put your 2 green regiments in the centre of the brigade line so that your flanks were held by seasoned troops, and that would allow those troops to, if you like, not bear the worst part of the battle if they were flanked or whatever. And so, but that becomes, that's problematic when you've got whole divisions that are made up of these and whole brigades that are made up of these new troops. But the greenness of those federal troops was certainly a factor in why McClellan isn't able to take those Confederate lines in the early part of the battle, I think.
So, I mean, it's not only the bloodiest day of the Civil War, but I think it might possibly be one of the bloodiest days in US military history. We've got 8,000 corpses lying out in the field. We've got another 12,000 or more wounded men. How is the battle, how is it proclaimed by both sides? Because I think, you know, nothing decisive was achieved at Antietam except a lot of casualties. What does each side now have to say about the battle?
So for Lee, it means the end of the campaign. It's a failed campaign. So whilst they held their own, and he's obviously very proud of the army for the way they fought, they haven't won a victory. But they could say they've won a moral victory in the fact that they weren't driven into the river and they weren't swallowed up by the Union forces or cut off as they should have been. So from the soldiers' perspective, they would have looked upon Antietam or Sharpsburg as a victory. For the Union, Lee leaves the battlefield, even though he stays there for a day and sticks his jaw out defiantly. He does leave the battlefield in federal hands. So it's a victory for the North. Lincoln, of course, who has been hard pressed now for since June with McClellan's failure on the peninsula, the defeat of John Pope in Virginia, so he's looking for a victory. And so, of course, Lincoln takes the opportunity on the 22nd of July, sorry, it's 22nd of September, after having visited the battlefield and visited McClellan at Sharpsburg, to issue the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. And basically what that proclamation was that it signaled the North's intention to actually free slaves in any Confederate-held territory or Confederate states from the 1st of July, from the 1st of January of 1863. And so that is a huge game changer for the Civil War. It shifts the focus of the war from one of maintaining the Union, preventing the dissolution of the Union, to one of a much higher order with the people's freedom at stake. And so you could argue that even though French and British intervention was always probably unlikely, it was certainly hoped for by certain people within the Confederacy, Confederate leaders, it certainly put an end to that possibility because the war, you know, the focus of the war had now changed to the freedom of a people, basically. And yes, it was wasn't met, that proclamation wasn't met uniformly with great joy by lots of people in the North, but nonetheless, Lincoln stuck to his guns, and it opened the door for that full emancipation that would occur after the Civil War. So it was hugely significant in that political context.
Well, it's a fascinating campaign and one that had important repercussions for the rest of the Civil War. Mate, I've enjoyed our chat today. I'm looking forward. We'll do a few more in the coming months as more great anniversaries come up, because I think Antietam is one of those battles that doesn't get the attention it deserves, particularly in Australia, doesn't get the attention it deserves. And these chapters of the Civil War are just so fascinating and so important to the overall story.
And look, I know a lot of your audience are people that are familiar with First World War battlefields and battlefields of other campaigns, Matt, and I can recommend going to Antietam as a place to go, as a battlefield experience. It is absolutely fascinating. It's one of those, it's not cluttered with monuments in the same way that Gettysburg is. That was a decision that was sort of made fairly early on, that it was seen very much as a soldier's battle, and that respect should be accorded. The other important aspect of of the battle was that photographs were taken, and Matthew Brady's photographs in particular of the dead on the battlefield, and they were exhibited in the north. And of course, those photographs brought home to many people the reality of what war was about, and what. So it was a real reality check for many people to see those photographs of dead. Even though the majority of the photographs were of southern dead, it was nonetheless a fairly confronting thing to see for people at that point in time.
Well, it's a fascinating battlefield. When I did my big tour of the American Civil War battlefields, it was probably the highlight, walking through that cornfield and overlooking the bridge. Just some, you know.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Some dramatic sights which bring it all home, particularly when, as you say, you compare those then and now photos. But Dale, thank you. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, mate, and to bring this alive. I really appreciate your enthusiasm for it, and it's something we'll certainly do again.
Thanks, Matt. Good on you.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.